results may sound pretty incredible, and maybe if we rewound, say, 8 years ago, this would be mind-blowing. But possibly the most remarkable thing about this is just how unremarkable this type of result is becoming, as we're learning more about the transformative nature of these types of programs across so many different settings.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The numbers who live in extreme poverty have dropped dramatically in the last few decades, but less so in fragile and conflict-affected areas. Can a big push from the Targeting the Ultra Poor program, you remember we discussed it recently on Vox Dev Talks, help in one of the most challenged countries in this respect, and that's Afghanistan. Guadalupe Bedoya and Aidan Coville of the World Bank, and also Mohammed Izakzadeh of Princeton, are three of the economists who have evaluated the results of a big push that attempted to lift 1,200 households out of poverty in Afghanistan. And they all join me now to talk about its accomplishments and the challenges that remain. So let's say welcome to all of you. So first of all, Lupe, welcome.
Hi, Tim.
Aidan.
Hey, Tim.
And Mohammed as well. Everyone's welcome on Vox Dev Talks, of course, but Mohammed, as an Afghan national, you are especially welcome.
Hi, Tim.
Now, Aidan, start me off. We discussed this targeting the ultra-poor strategy in relation to India a few weeks ago. And for people who didn't catch that podcast, what were you doing? Listen to it after this one. What is this big push? What sort of households would typically receive it?
I guess there's a lot of things to like about big push interventions, but one of the very useful things is actually just how descriptive the name is, just using two words, right? I guess so we could have called this something like an integrated, multidimensional, time-bound poverty alleviation approach, but that doesn't really roll off the tongue quite as much as
a
big push. So I guess one way to explain the idea is just imagine you're walking along and you see somebody struggling and they're not able to get out of a swimming pool. And so the first thing you want to do is go and help them just to make sure they stay afloat, right? But then, if you can muster it, ideally you'd like to give them a big push out of the pool. And it's a bit of a win-win here, right? It's a once-off action, so you don't have to stay there anymore helping them keep their head above water. And on the other hand, now the person can go off and be the best that they can be without spending all of their efforts struggling to survive. So big push interventions, and sometimes they're called graduation programs, sometimes targeting the ultra-poor programs, or multifaceted livelihoods programs, they all have the same basic premise in mind in their design. Let's provide a big push in the form of a large, multifaceted, one-off package to households experiencing extreme poverty. And by doing so, we can help create sustainable livelihoods. The origins come from BRAC in Bangladesh, but this has since been adapted and applied to all sorts of different countries all over the world, including India, as you just mentioned earlier. And so the TUP program in Afghanistan targets the ultra-poor woman and provides them with a productive asset. And then this is combined with a structured training, individualized bi-weekly mentoring, a basic cash stipend, and other complementary health, education, and financial services for 12 months. So programs in other countries sometimes tweak this design, for instance, allowing the program to last for maybe 2 years, and the assets might be switched out for a large financial grant, so households have more choice in what they invest in, for example, but they ultimately follow the same broad structure and principles. The project presented a unique opportunity to understand how effective these big push programs might be in fragile and conflict settings where, as you mentioned, this is where the majority of the world's extreme poor actually live. So we've been working in Afghanistan for the last 10 years or so, really running this evaluation of this program with the Microfinance Investment Support Facility, or MISFA for short, as the implementing partner. And now we're all acutely aware of how much change there's been in Afghanistan over the past year. And so just to clarify to the listeners, this work comes from findings from a few years ago in 2019, and we'll also soon be able to share longer-term results from data collected just prior to the regime change last year.
Mohammed, as Aidan points out, many of the world's ultra-poor are in these fragile, conflict-affected areas. What are the particular challenges in a conflict setting if we are trying to help the poorest people there?
There are multiple challenges in a conflict and fragile setting such as Afghanistan. The most important challenge, I think, is related to the implementation of the intervention in conflict setting. Security issues and conflict-related shocks may undermine the successful implementation of the intervention. When you conduct an impact evaluation of the intervention, it would be very difficult to parse out the role of implementation constraints from the underlying economic and social factors that could influence the effectiveness of the intervention in conflict setting. women are more constrained in conflict and fragile settings than in more stable settings, which would make the program difficult to work if our target is women. But precisely because of that, the program could also have higher impact than in other settings.
Lupe, let's think about the people that we're trying to help here. Can you describe the sort of living conditions, the level of poverty for the households that received help through this program?
These households were extremely vulnerable. 80% of them were below the national poverty line before the intervention started. And when we compare them with the rest of the population in their villages, they were worse off in any dimension that we measure: human capital, financial capital, economic opportunities, you name it. The numbers are really striking. For instance, 96% of ultra-poor women in these households were illiterate. Half of the girls in school age were out of school. Only 2% of ultra-poor households saved anything, and 68% of them were in debt. But this debt was mostly for consumption rather than investment, which of course makes it harder to repay. And overall, these households face also very high levels of underemployment, which means that they work much less than what they wish to work. As you can see, all these conditions reflect vulnerabilities across multiple dimensions, and that is one of the key reasons why we expected that a big push intervention could help improve these conditions.
But of course, we can't pretend that the 1,200 households that were in this program were the only ones at that level of poverty. What were the criteria to be selected for this intervention?
Tim, actually, the process of selecting households was a participatory process, which was led by the communities and supported by the government. So the villagers decided and determined who were the poorest in the village. And in that process, they used certain proxies and criteria to identify the poorest household. For instance, a household was financially dependent on women's domestic work or begging, or household owned no land or very small tract of land. The household had no active adult men income earner. Household children of age, school age, were working for pay, and a household did not owe any productive assets. And using these proxies, at the end, the communities, they selected the beneficiaries. And at the end, 6% of village households fell within this category and were identified as ultra-poor households.
Lupe, the program targeted aid specifically at women, Aidan said. Why did you target it at women, and what did these women receive?
There are several reasons why we would like to target women in this type of intervention and setting, and all of them are related to gender gaps. Worldwide, poverty rates are higher among women than men. In conflict settings like this one, women's vulnerabilities are aggravated because there is a higher incidence of shocks, and shocks tend to affect women disproportionately. And in Afghanistan in particular, these constraints are compounded by conservative social norms that limit further women's economic opportunities. Let me give you a few figures that put this in perspective. Ultra-poor women have 10 percentage points higher illiteracy rate than men, or half of the years of education that men receive. They are much less likely to participate in market work than adult men. They also earn less than men when they work for pay, receiving 44 cents for every dollar that men receive. And women in Afghanistan also have the lowest empowerment in the world, in measured by indicators. In all the countries where we have data and we can compare, they have the lowest women's empowerment. In this context, as you can see, with significant constraints for women, the TUP program provides economic opportunities through a package that Aidan already mentioned that have five main components. First, it was a transfer of a productive asset, typically cows and occasionally sheep and goats, a skills training conducted before the livestock was transferred and also throughout the beginning of the month, a monthly cash transfer stipend for 12 months that was aiming at avoiding that households would liquidate the asset if they didn't have to eat, or to prevent these situations, biweekly coaching visits for 1 year, facilitation to access many other services such as savings, healthcare, education. So it was a very holistic package, as you can see.
Mohammed, there is implicit in this an idea that this big push creates some sort of process that will lift these households out of the poverty trap. So what is that mechanism here?
In theory, there are at least three potential mechanisms by which this intervention could uplift the ultra-poor household from poverty. The first mechanism is through providing a startup capital, which is rarely available for ultra-poor households. In Afghanistan, for instance, the banking sector was underdeveloped, and the ultra-poor household in our sample rarely had bank accounts, formal savings, or access to loans. Actually, only 5% of villages in this study reported the presence of a microfinance institution, while none reported the presence of a bank. Only 2% of ultra-poor households reported to have some sort of savings, while 68% reported to have debts. So within this context, providing the startup capital would be the key for uplifting ultra-poor from poverty. The second mechanism through which this intervention could help beneficiaries escape poverty is through alleviating psychological constraints, such as depression, low aspirations, and scarcity-driven behavior. And studies have shown that these psychological constraints undermine productivity and entrepreneurship. And finally, the third mechanism is through coaching and training beneficiaries to better utilize non-human capital. At first glance, rearing livestock may seem an easy task, but it is a very complex task for those without experience. From feeding livestock to marketing and selling the livestock producers require numerous skills and substantial experiences. The intervention offered coaching and training to the beneficiaries at every stage of the process. In the paper, however, we do not isolate the mechanisms, since the big push wants to address all these three constraints at the same time.
What does success look like here? What sort of outcomes are you trying to measure, and how long do you wait to measure them, Lupi?
Well, we measure multiple dimensions of well-being, including indicators that are typically measured in similar studies. Of course, we have an important group of outcomes related to economic well-being, including consumption, asset, labor participation, earnings, financial indicators. We also measure human capital indicators like children's health and education to try to understand how the intervention could affect this intergenerational human capital formation. And we measure psychological well-being with self-reported measures like depression, happiness, but we also use a biomarker for stress through the levels of cortisol from saliva samples. But two areas that we focus a lot on are women's empowerment and gender equality, which, of course, for everything that we have discussed today, are very important indicators of well-being this setting. We measure women's empowerment across four dimensions: decision-making, which is a proxy for women's agency or their ability to make choices and decisions that they want related to households and also to herself; economic opportunities, including indicators that were targeted by the program, such as participation in market work, but we also include a lot of indicators that were not targeted by the program. For instance, whether women are owners or managers of self-employment enterprise other than livestock or agriculture, effective access to inputs, including whether they own a mobile phone for themselves or whether they have financial assets in their name and separate from others. And we also measure political involvement and social capital that usually aim at measuring agency at the community level. In addition, we measure women's aspiration for daughters as a proxy for social norms, including, for instance, the level of education that they desire their daughters to have or the age that they want them to marry. And because we measure these outcomes for multiple household members, we were also able to estimate the impact on gender equality, on market work, psychological well-being, children's education, and ownership of assets. We first measured the short-term impacts of the program 2 years after the asset transfer, which are the results that we are discussing today. We also measure long-term impacts of the program 4 years after the asset transfer, and those results are coming up in the next month, so stay tuned for a future.
Aidan, can you give me the highlights of the results that you found from this?
We saw pretty much on every single dimension that Lupe mentioned, we found significant and meaningful improvements from consumption to psychological well-being, labor force participation, all the way through to financial inclusion. So people really were becoming happier, healthier, and more productive. Possibly most exciting was actually to see how the program improved women's empowerment, which was a key area that we were exploring. And this was across a range of different dimensions and started also to close the gender gaps that we had seen in the baseline on things like workforce participation, asset ownership, and psychological well-being. And in terms of the cost, well, a conservative estimate only focusing on the improvements in consumption, which conveniently we can actually monetize, suggested that for every $1 spent on the program participants experience about $2.3 worth of consumption returns. And this turned out to be about a 26% return on investment. So this means that even in a weird consumption-focused dystopian world where we don't care at all about people's happiness, self-worth, health, and education, and we can still justify the cost of the intervention based simply just on the household consumption alone. So for anybody thinking about where to put their next dollar, unlike investments in the S&P 500, investing in the TUP program can actually still get sizable returns even during a conflict.
But returns vary, don't they, Lupe? How does this compare to previous results that have been found in more stable contexts?
In terms of impacts on economic indicators, these results were very favorable and on the higher side of the spectrum. For example, we find an impact on consumption of 29%, which is larger than the highest increases in more stable countries such as Ethiopia, India, Bangladesh, where impacts on consumption were between 18 and 21%, 3 to 4 years after the asset transfer. Remember that our impacts were 2 years after the asset transfer. So there is a little bit of difference between the timeline, but they are good comparisons nonetheless. And as Aidan mentioned, our women's empowerment are very large. The impacts on our women's empowerment measures are very large and significant, which do differ considerably from the results in more stable settings. These large impacts on women's empowerment seem in conflict with the evidence from Banerjee and co-authors and Bandiera and co-authors for Ethiopia, Ghana, Honduras, India, Pakistan, Peru, and Bangladesh, which show that except in Pakistan, the TUP intervention did not lead to large and significant impacts on women's empowerment. So we did a lot of work trying to understand why the difference were so large. And we found out that our results actually are very consistent with the evidence from these countries. What explains the large differences is that these studies measure women empowerment mostly focused on indicators based on decision making, which are proxies for women agency within the household. But of course, it's only one dimension of women's empowerment. When we reestimate the impacts on women's empowerment in Afghanistan using only that dimension, we find very similar effects, which is basically that the intervention didn't affect these decision-making measures of women's empowerment. When we expanded these measures of women's empowerment to the dimensions that I explained previously, is what explained this large difference. And these results highlight how important it is to measure expanded dimensions of women's empowerment beyond decision making, which can better reflect the multidimensionality of women's empowerment involving many aspects of women's lives, the relationships to their family, community members, and other formal and informal institutions like, you know, relationship to markets. In terms of gender equality, we actually hadn't seen any other TUP study conducted before ours that estimated the impact of the program on these elements. And it is very exciting to see that the program was able to reduce gaps across many dimensions like Aidan mentioned.
Excitement of the whole team about these results really does come through, both what you're saying now and in the paper as well. Did this surprise you to get such a big effect?
The results may sound pretty incredible, and maybe if we rewound, say, 8 years ago, this would be mind-blowing. But possibly the most remarkable thing about this is just how unremarkable this type of result is becoming. As we're learning more about the transformative nature of these types of programs across so many different settings, this is becoming sort of something that we see consistently around the world with these types of programs. So it's kind of hard to imagine, but if we go back to 2013, when we first started working on this, there was very little to go by other than just a willingness to try new things. When we were first asked to help evaluate the program, there was a lot of skepticism. Think about how many difficulties there are just trying to implement something as simple as financial literacy training programs in fragile settings. And then the implementing partner says, hey, that's peanuts. We're going the whole hog and we want to give everybody cows, a whole bunch of tailored training and coaching, and do all of this in a sequence package to achieve great things. We spent long discussions about this as to whether something like this could actually really be justified. I mean, providing $2,000 in support to each household without even knowing if the thing could be delivered takes a big leap of faith. But Over time, the skepticism turned into intrigue, the intrigue turned into hope, and from hope to us becoming actually weird born-again converts. And so how did this actually happen? Well, first, by working with MISVA, who was the implementing partner, we realized just how passionate they were about the program. And not only that, how thoughtful they had been in fine-tuning the program through extensive piloting to be ready for scale-up. Having such a strong and dedicated implementing partner was really such a crucial part of the program's success. And then, at the time the work was just getting ready to be implemented, the results from Bangladesh and the multi-country study that Lupa had mentioned were very conveniently just coming out, showing the incredible potential of this type of program, and that provided more further impetus for us to keep going. And finally, with the extensive monitoring activities that we had in place to keep track of progress of implementation, we started to see that, hey, all of the intervention components were actually being implemented as planned. Despite all of this, there was still a lot of uncertainty about whether the constraints women faced in Afghanistan would just be too numerous to overcome in any meaningful way just from one program. But long story short, the magnitude of the effects was definitely a pleasant surprise. But when it came to actually doing the number crunching, knowing the results from some of the other studies and how well the intervention was actually implemented on the ground in Afghanistan, we were definitely a lot less surprised than if you had asked our 2013 selves the same question.
But, Mohammed, I want to bring you in on this one. These results, as Aidan mentioned at the beginning, are now several years old. And as everybody knows, a lot's happened in Afghanistan since then. It's in an economic crisis at the moment, very concerning for all of us. And you can imagine that a lot of people are being pushed back into poverty. These big pushes are expensive interventions. And does this maybe suggest that something like this might not be the best use of resources in one of these fragile settings?
Afghanistan has changed a lot since we conducted the impact evaluation. So it would be difficult to say what would be the impacts of the intervention if it were implemented now. And these are speculative ideas, but we think still the big push has certain advantages in a fragile context such as Afghanistan, particularly given the recent economic crisis. Unfortunately, Afghanistan's economy has shrunk dramatically. Job opportunities in the formal economy have diminished. Women in particular have suffered much more than men since their participation in the labor market and in the formal economy has become very limited given the recent developments in the country. So the intervention offers self-employment opportunities for women outside the formal economy, where their participation is very limited. So while women can rarely find jobs in the public or private sector of Afghanistan now, this intervention helps them earn income and support their household while working from home. So the shrinkage of employment opportunities outside home may not limit as much the women who are self-employed and work from home. And we think the intervention could be relevant also in other fragile contexts where women may not be able to participate in the labor market or work outside home because of security issues or other constraints.
Aidan, this is a story of a huge hope and great accomplishment, but also enormous challenges and an unclear future for Afghanistan. So what do you think is the future for anti-poverty programs in the region? Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
I guess, Tim, there's been such a recent surge in investments on the back of the growing evidence regarding how transformative and cost-effective these types of livelihood programs can be over the last few years. So just to give you an idea of scale, the Partnership for Economic Inclusion released their State of Economic Inclusion report in 2021, and they found that there are now 219 different economic inclusion programs around the world supporting 92 million people. So this is massive, and it's actually growing. To your specific question, regionally, about a third of these recipients are from South Asia, so highlighting just how much traction there's been in the region. As these programs continue to conquer poverty around the world, the key question now is how to improve the cost effectiveness and integrate these interventions into national, government-led programs. On the one hand, some interesting recent work by our colleagues Florence Condilis and John Losser collate the evidence to explore the cost-effectiveness of cash transfers versus multifaceted TUP or graduation-type programs, and they find that the relative to simple cash transfers, graduation-type programs can generate larger impacts, but due to the increased costs, they can actually often end up being less cost-effective than simple cash transfers. Mm. On the other hand, though, exciting new evidence from places like Niger are showing how costs can be dramatically reduced by delivering activities through national programs, and how these impacts can be increased by adding components targeting things like psychosocial development, for instance. I'd say at this point in time, I'm actually quite bullish for the future of these programs. Ultimately, though, if we are truly serious about eradicating poverty, finding solutions that work in the most fragile places for the most marginalized people is absolutely fundamental. This is where the majority of the world's extreme poor live, and also where women and girls in particular face the most significant constraints to development. The results from Afghanistan offer a lot of hope that eradicating extreme poverty may actually be within our grasp.
I wish you all the best with your work. That was a fascinating conversation. Aidan, thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
And Lupe as well.
Thank you, Tim. A pleasure to be here.
And finally, Mohammed.
Thank you, Tim, for having us.
It is a privilege to be able to have some of these conversations. You can read about it in the paper. The paper is called No Household Left Behind, Afghanistan Targeting the Ultra-Poor Impact Evaluation. And the authors are Guadalupe Bedoya, Aidan Coville, Johannes Haushofer, Mohammed Izakzadeh, and Jeremy Shapiro. This has been a VoxDev Talk. Now, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. Go on, do it now on whatever podcast platform you use. You'll find VoxDev Talks is there. But remember, all our past episodes, as well as articles that cover the papers that we feature, are at voxdev.org.